Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Up. Publicity.com, welcoming you this Saturday and every Saturday for education, enlightenment, entertainment about the issues surrounding the aftermath of crime and tragedy. And so I want to say good evening again, everyone across the nation. It's always nice to have our audience, whether you are a first-time listener or a returning listener. We always strive to have new people come in and join our ranks because we feel it's an ongoing commitment and part of our mission to educate people to the issues. And seldom do we have a lot of repeat guests, but we have a favorite repeat guest this evening because it is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And I will do a brief introduction in just a minute or so. But first, want to welcome my delightful co-host, Delilah. Hi, it's been a little while since we've been on the radio. How are you?
Yeah, it's nice to be back doing live radio again, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I had a little sabbatical for a number of different reasons, and I have to say I think we did a good job with our marathon shows. I hope that people enjoyed those. But, you know, this is the beginning of October, and October signals a number of different activities. And with your position as a publicist and all the activities you're involved with, I wondered if maybe before we introduce our guests, could you give our listeners a little bit of a rundown in terms of the events that everyone may be involved with and may want to listen and read?
Well, actually, you know, Domestic Violence Awareness Month comes every October, and it's in the midst of a lot of other well-known issues like Breast Cancer Awareness Month and several others that I can't really tell you right now because I can't remember. But, you know, we just don't want all of these issues to get lost within each other. So, of course, every issue has its color, every issue has its ribbon and so forth, but anyway, my focus on Domestic Violence Awareness Month becomes very, very real to me every October for a lot of different reasons. As you know, Susan Murphy Milano was a very good friend of mine, mentor, colleague, whatever you want to call it, and that was her life's work. And several years ago, we created a blog together called Time's Up, searching out solutions, SOS, for not just victims of domestic violence, but we invited writers to guest blog on numerous, whether it be, you know, spiritual, whether it be from a therapist's viewpoint, from an advocate's viewpoint. So that particular blog has just done tremendous things with getting information out there, making it available. It's got a lot of wonderful posts from a lot of wonderful writers and many with a lot of conversation going on in the comment section. So that's really great to know that people are reading it and they are acquiring the information. So we're doing another push. We've invited a lot of people who, you know, others may not be familiar with, who are loyal readers to the blog. But that address is timesupblog.blogspot.com. So we invite everybody to come there, look around, you know, read the articles, learn, and then pass it on. Pass on the information. It's not going to do anybody any good sitting on a page on a website or someone that prints it out. You know, get involved in the conversations. Talk about it, because the more we educate, the more we make people aware of the issue and the tools that are available, which brings me to the next website, Document the Abuse, which houses all of the information about the Evidentiary Abuse Affidavit, the EAA, which was Susan's, you know, the culmination of all of her work, actually, was creating this tool, which goes very, very well in every safety planning toolbox. It's a must, and it's available. All the information and everything is available on documenttheabuse.com. So, again, I invite listeners, anyone out there, to come to the website, look around, be familiar with it. If you are a victim and you need help with this, there are people that you can contact there. So it's all there to help.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess I can't just leave it with Domestic Violence Awareness Month, because both of us are involved with Q Center for Missing Persons.
Yes.
Susan was as well. And they every year they do a National On the Road to Remember Tour, which again brings awareness to a lot of missing persons cases that may not be getting attention or may have never gotten attention. And so we bring the media to you, basically. So this year they're leaving Wilmington, North Carolina, going all the way up to where you are, Donna, in Connecticut, going over all the way over to Minnesota and back down, all within a period of about 10 days. So it's quite a mission, but it accomplishes so much. So again, if you're, please go to ncmissingpersons.org, check out the National Road Tour posting. If you scroll down, mm-hmm. there's a whole list of all of the stops. And if you live in any of those areas, I really encourage you to come out and support the families. Do what you can to just support them. Just being there supports them. You don't have to give anything. You don't have to do anything. Just be there.
Right. And it's okay. Called On the Road to Remember Tour. Yeah, so
correct.
Thank you. That was an excellent synopsis of a lot of the very important things that are going on. And just one little thing, and then I'll get to Elmira, I promise. The other person, Chief Marty Sumner, was on maybe a month or two ago, and he has a wonderful offender-based program for victims of domestic violence, and he is from High Point, North Carolina. And we're very happy we're going to have him on a second time. It's another very unique tool and very, very effective tool. And if people want more information, they can certainly go. I wrote a blog and a very good radio show. So with that said, we kind of have the icing on the cake. Now we're coming to the cake. Elmira Raven, I think I met her at least about a year ago in Charleston. And I was very impressed with her because her heart is certainly in the right place. She has a multitude of experience in many areas. She's very learned, very dedicated, very creative. And she has been the executive director of My Sister's House in North Charleston, South Carolina, for a number of years. I believe it was founded way back in 1980, which, if my math is correct, it's something like 34 years. And so, you know, that is quite a legacy. And not only do they help people with respect to the crisis issues, but, you know, they have fun things like yoga and massage therapy and all of that part of the healing process. And so we kind of covered some of the basics in our first show, but we wanted to have her back because there's so much more to learn. And we also are very blessed to have a volunteer colleague of hers by the name of Joanne, who has a personal story to share, and she also works with their Survivors Council. So with that, both Delilah and I say welcome, Elmira and Joanne. It's such a pleasure to have you on Shattered Life again.
We're glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's our pleasure to have you. And so, you know, no, every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And for for the benefit of those who maybe were just tuning in, and this is their first hearing about my sister's house, Elmira, if you would do the honors and perhaps give us a brief overview of your organization, I think that might be a nice way to start.
As you said, we were started in 1980, and we'll be 34 years old this year by a group of volunteers who saw a need for our services. And so those services have expanded to include the basic services, the crisis line, and 24-hour day shelter. It also includes a children's program, outreach services, counseling, therapy, a lot of community-based activities, and training of police departments. And, of course, we provide all the basics, food, clothing, transportation, assistance with first month's rent, utility deposits, and our ultimate goal, of course, is for women and their children to live free from abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed, and that can certainly be a big challenge. And you were able to, in your, 9,500 square foot building at present, you're able to house 36 people, is that right?
36 women and children, yes.
36 women and children. And am I right, and does my memory serve me correctly, that in the future you're fundraising or you had put forth applying for a grant to maybe have a larger space for yourself?
Yes, we've purchased the property for a new facility, and so we'll be starting the capital campaign for a larger facility.
Wonderful. And how long a process is that, actually?
Well, I'm thinking, a capital campaign normally runs anywhere from 2.5 to 3 years, especially when you're raising millions of dollars.
Yeah. Okay. So it's definitely a long-term goal. But,
yes,
I know. Unless you happen to know what Donald Trump's telephone number or something. I think that gives us a little bit of a framework from which to work here. And so with that said, in all the years of experience that you have had, can you kind of give us a retrospective in terms of what does this month mean to you both personally and professionally in sort of an evolution stance, Elmira?
Well, I think that observing Domestic Violence Awareness Month is important, even though, of course, victims experience domestic violence every month. But it does give us the opportunity to highlight the issue during this month. So we were on Channel 2 on October 1st, kicking off National Domestic Violence Awareness Month with the Pharmathon. And so we were on the 5 a.m. news and the 5 p.m. news.
Wow.
And it was a great opportunity for us to be able to not only highlight our organization and the services, but to have individuals call in that may want to volunteer or donate, or even victims themselves that may have needed our services.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like it was very successful then, huh?
It was.
Great. So you're definitely able to showcase activities. In order for people to know kind of what your challenge is in terms of the numbers and where Charleston itself or North Charleston and South Carolina ranks, can you kind of give us an update in terms of that? What are you contending with?
Well, up until last month, we were ranked number one in the nation for the number of women murdered by men, and we're now number two. However, we have been in the top 10 for the past 17 years, and we actually have ranked number one 3 times in 10 years. So for us, it is an ongoing issue to address women being killed, period.
Mm-hmm. And for those of us who are wondering, I believe you may have answered this question before, but what are those important factors that keep you up there in the top, in your opinion?
I think key, of course, is the fact that we do have a lot of rural areas in our state, and domestic violence in a lot of people's minds, it's a secretive and it's a family issue and it's not anybody's business. And we also rank very low when it comes to education and employment. And a lot of times women stay because of financial reasons. You know, they're not, or they feel like they're not able to take care of themselves and their children, or they're not going to be able to find a job or housing. And so housing can be a big challenge for domestic violence victims.
Is that perhaps one, besides the actual physical, emotional abuse, would that rank maybe up near the high, one of the highest reasons why people may come to my sister's house in terms of not having another physical place to go to?
Well, they come to my sister's house really more for safety, because usually the clients that we see, it's not necessarily the first time they have left their abusive situation. And so we're a safe haven for them when they come to our shelter.
Okay. That's what I thought. Now, there was something referenced that the past attorney general had put forth an initiative called STOP, Violence Against Women Program, which was enacted in 1996. What does that program entail? And to your way of thinking, has that been an effective measure, or are there other things that, you know, Governor Haley and the legislature may be doing or should be doing in the future?
Well, I think the national program, of course, did generate additional funds. That's always helpful. But on a local level, we have had an ad hoc committee put together at our state legislative level to look at the domestic violence laws. And that came about due to the excellent five-part series that Post and Courier did entitled Till Death Do Us Part. And so we worked very closely with them on that for a year, and I think it definitely was worth the effort.
What I heard about that from my co-host, Delilah, because I believe she read all of that.
It was the best expose I think I've ever read. It was just really, really well researched and very well written. So, and I was so happy to see your part in that, Elmire. It was very eye-opening. When you have cases that are prosecutable, has the South Carolina Attorney General's office been, are they cooperative towards providing successful prosecutions? How does that all go about? Let's say, for instance, if the victim isn't cooperating or doesn't want to go forward with a prosecution, what happens next?
Unfortunately, there is still a lot of plea bargaining, which I really always have concerns about. Because when you plea bargain down a crime, then it really lessens that crime and the importance of the crime. It really makes that perpetrator think, okay, well, I got to slip on the wrist. I can do this again. So there's always still a lot of plea bargaining.
Oh, is that due to just the sheer volume, Elmire?
I'm sure volume is part of it, but I also think that even though the victim should not have to cooperate, it should be victimless prosecution. But I think if the victim does not cooperate, then there's probably more plea bargaining.
I see. Well, you know, I'm wondering from the perspective of being of being a survivor, and I'd like to bring in our other guest if we can. Joanne, are you in fact a survivor of intimate partner violence?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Would you mind sharing whatever parts of your experience you feel comfortable with us and our audience?
Yes, I can share some.
Okay, thank you.
My experience, I was married for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And being a military wife, I felt alone. And as Amir stated, there's some shame that goes with it, and you really don't want to speak out. But it came out because I ended up in the hospital. And surviving for me, it wasn't an option. I had two children that had to be taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
So once I got professional help, and when I say professional help, I had someone, I had the organization that helped me to safety, and I had a job, but I still needed that emotional support. So once I got to that point, then I got better. I got better. It stays with you because the physical part goes away, but the emotional and mental stays with you. And
mm-hmm.
I wanted to say to women that there is a way out, and that is why I am on the Survivors Council, to show them that there is life after abuse, and you can continue on.
Mm-hmm. How did you get introduced to My Sister's House? In what manner did you initiate getting help at some particular point in the process, and or did somebody else refer you, or how did that happen?
Actually, I got involved after being involved with a second relationship. And I went to the sheriff's department, wherein a victim's advocate stepped in and guided me. She came to court with me and until I was able to get an attorney. And from there, I sought help and actually ended up in a program, a 16-week survivor's program, wherein they took me from where I was to show me how to survive and got me my confidence back. So after that, I decided that I wanted to give back. I felt that I had to do something. So after being free from that relationship over a year and a half, I came and started volunteering at My Sister's House.
That's wonderful. It sounds like you've maybe come full circle. But what just occurred to me also, can you tell me if you were a military wife, what services within that realm were available, or did you know, or did you seek out at that point in time, or are they very different than what the private sector offers?
I am not sure what else they have. The only thing that they offered, because again, being military back then, it was kind of kept within the system.
Within the right.
Yes, I attended an Al-Anon meeting, and that was it, because he was an alcoholic. And that was all that was provided for me. And I did not, again, not knowing what was out there, that was the only thing that I had right then and there.
But I do know now that they have family violence units. They have advocates that work within those units that will work with domestic violence victims that are military. Because I have one of my best friends, she's over at the social work department at the base in Columbia. So
it's more highly developed at this point than it was for Joanne back then. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, Almir, we'd love to hear about what she does at the what you do at the Survivors Council. But Almir, how do you? I know I just feel in my heart that you're selective about people that come aboard and help others. How do you choose your volunteers in terms of serving others? What's the process and what do you look for?
Well, it's a very lengthy process, but we primarily look for commitment and, of course, empathy and understanding of the issue from any volunteer. We have an orientation session, and that not only gives the prospective volunteer the opportunity to hear more about us, but for us to observe that prospective volunteer as we're providing information to them. Then they would go to the basic volunteer training, and then at that time they would go through that training, and they may decide this is more than I bargained for. And, of course, we have to do SLED checks, child abuse checks, sex offender registry checks. So there is a lengthy background check as well.
Uh-huh.
And then once they get through that process, then they would do an on-the-job volunteer training.
I see. And is that for a number of weeks? And, you know, kind of my job coached, or I just use that term.
Well, they would be paired with their volunteer.
Uh-huh. I see.
So if they were in the line, yeah, they would be paired with an experienced volunteer during their training time.
Well, very good. Joanne, how long have you been volunteering, and what has been your experience overall, and is anything in particular that it sounds like it's been very meaningful and therapeutic for you? But if someone is listening out there and has come to the point in their life where maybe they're able to do something like this, can you share your story in terms of that aspect?
Yes, I've been doing it now for a couple of years. If someone is interested in doing it, I would say for me it's fulfillment. Having a victim's advocate there with me in court was probably the biggest morale booster for me, because it told me that I was not alone, and being able to give back is the main thing. I think that's the most important thing for me, is the fact that I am able to give back, and it does make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, in what ways do you feel like you're giving back? What is it specifically that you are doing to help the other people at the shelter, so we can kind of get a visual picture?
Okay, one of being on the council, as part of what we do, we go out and we speak. When you're speaking to an audience, it makes a difference when they can put a face with a situation. And when you're speaking out, recently I just spoke at a church, and not knowing that I had touched someone, I had several women that actually stood up and said that they were either abused or they had daughters that were abused. And they were very thankful that, you know, we were able to stand up and give out and share our experience, because then they no longer felt like they were ashamed or something that should be kept in the closet.
But then did they, as an example, take that next step and say, okay, can I have more information about resources and about my sister's house, or what law enforcement or victim advocates can do, during those presentations? Do you connect them right away with resources if you're able?
Yes, we do. We travel with our brochures and have the information there for them, and the brochure has everything that they need to know, all the hotline numbers and everything.
Now, Amir, knowing that you only have space for 36 residents, including families and women and children, how is it that you prioritize who actually gets shelter and who, unfortunately, you have to turn away to other places?
Well, we're really blessed that we don't have to turn away very many victims. Our community-based program is quite large, so we're in court every day. We have Spanish-speaking advocates as well as our other advocates, so we're in court in the three counties that we serve, which are Berkeley, Charleston, and Dorchester. We provide support groups in all of the three counties we serve, as well as a support group at Florence Crittenden, which is the home for unwed mothers, and Charleston Center, which is our substance abuse facility. So our community-based services are relatively large as well. And there are some victims that don't need shelter, but they do need other services, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I'm sure that, you know, a lot of people maybe think that, you know, everyone needs shelter, but I'm glad that you did say that, because there are a whole spectrum of services, and it just depends upon where they are in the process as to what they need, correct? And it's kind of like a triage situation in an emergency room. I kind of view it as that, right, depending on what the circumstances are?
Yes, because everyone doesn't necessarily need shelter. They may need someone to go to court with them. They
mm-hmm.
may already have family support. They may already have a job, and they have support on that job. Their employer may be supportive. So they really just need us to help them walk through the system and what they need to do to
and
move
you,
forward and get an order
of
protection.
You have an assessment that you do, like a checklist assessment, is that right, when you first meet or when you first do your intake?
Well, when they call the crisis line, that's one level of assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they come into the shelter, then there's another set of questions. And once
mm-hmm.
they're in the shelter, then there's a more in-depth assessment.
Okay.
And that's done by our licensed therapist. But
okay.
if they are in a community-based support group, then that support group coordinator would be the one assessing that individual and helping her walk through the options. We also provide some one-on-one sessions for victims that may be still in their situation and they can't attend our support groups. And
mm-hmm.
usually those are two or three sessions just to kind of move her along and help her to know what options she have available. So it's not ongoing counseling.
Right.
It is
Thank
her
you.
Opportunity to be able to really look at what options she has available to her.
I see. Now in partaking of your services, would you describe them as I hate to use this word, but mandatory, and some of them are mandatory and some of them are optional? Is it like a sort of picking from a menu, or do you know, once you kind of sign on, you have to do X, Y, Z, but these other things you may or may not want to do? Is that how it works?
Well, we try to be flexible as much as possible, but counseling and therapy, they are a mandatory part of our program because our ultimate goal is to help that woman help herself and to look at the situation she's in and hopefully not go back into the situation she's in. So for
yeah.
her and her children, counseling is a mandatory part of our program.
I see. Joanne, what aspects of the program from My Sister's House were you able to take advantage of for your situation?
For me, it was having the victim's advocate and
mm-hmm.
Through the counseling program.
Okay, so the main things that are kind of the most important ingredients here and for success and safety and moving on with your life. You know, I was very impressed with how detailed and kind of well mapped out your safety plan is. Did that strike you too, Delilah, when you saw her safety plan and knowing what Susan's was? I thought that theirs was very well developed as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so it's everybody does it a little bit differently, but the tools are pretty much the same. And there's several things in each individual case. Certain things are going to fit for certain victims, and they're not going to fit for others. So that, I think that was the thing that Susan and had always preached about, was that each case has to be looked at individually. And each tool needs to be directed towards the circumstances in that particular case.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm wondering if someone has made an attempt, whether it be, you know, someone coming right from a, you know, an emergency room or the first meeting in a police department. Elmira, is there such a thing as a good safety plan versus a bad one?
Well, I'm sure there probably is, but I would hope that as our advocates, we all work together, that we're all kind of on the same page. And in our area, we're very fortunate in that we have our Tri-County Victim Advocates Council, which was started by my sister's house a number of years ago. They were trying to remind me of when I started it. And it's still going strong, and all of the advocates in our three counties belong to that group. And so they meet on a monthly basis. They have various speakers to talk about topics of interest to the group as a whole as it relates to victims. And so I think all of our ultimate goals are to provide safety and the best resources for the victims we serve.
Well, Amir, what, you know, you've been at this for a long time. We don't have to say how many years, but I know it's been a long time. And since you started My Sister's House, or you became involved in the whole issue of domestic violence, what improvements have you seen that have come through over the years? And that, let's say, if we come back here a year from now, where do you think the most improvement needs to be made in South Carolina? What can we talk about next year that's going to get done?
Well, I have no problem with saying how long I have been working at my sister's house. It's been 25 years, and I've seen many, many changes, not just in the services that we provide, but in the services that are provided all across the state, as well as the number of programs that we provide. When I started, we didn't have victim advocate. We didn't have anybody that went to court, per se, with our clients. We didn't have a children's counselor. So there were very limited services, primarily shelter and the 24-hour crisis line. And so I've seen almost all of the programs across the state that have added these needed components, because children are the silent victims in this particular issue, and they will be either the victim or abusers of tomorrow if we don't try to break this cycle.
Right, and next cycle.
Yes. I was here a year from now, I think legislation would be the biggest thing that I would like to see change. Stiffer legislation, that is.
And what are the obstacles? Why are there roadblocks here that South Carolina has experienced in getting these tougher laws passed?
Well, a lot of it has to do with our legislature, because that's where the laws have to go. So we continue to work with them, and we are hoping that this ad hoc committee, whose sole responsibility is to look at the domestic violence laws and try to strengthen those laws. So we're hoping that there will be some positive outcomes from that committee.
But is it a matter of, like in our state, we have many legislators on both sides of the aisle that have been there for years and years and years and make it a career and make a lot of promises about doing this, that, and the other. And essentially they do make that a career, and it's not so much what they're doing for the people as opposed to what they're doing for their own career. Is there appropriate turnover in sort of new blood, so to speak, and new ideas in your legislature? And what is Governor Haley's, where is this on her priority list as well? Can you kind of gauge that for us?
I don't know that we have a whole lot of turnover in our legislature, even though we do have some relatively new folks in the legislature now. The overall position is that we have some folks that are real supporters, and we have those that are not. And so on this appointed ad hoc committee, we have some of both. And so I would say the ultimate goal is to try to pull them together and have them work together to look at the pieces of legislation that got nowhere last year at all. And try to bring those forth and get them passed.
Yeah.
Ultimately will be stronger legislation for domestic violence victims.
Well, how do you feel the general public can get involved in making this happen? I mean, is there a way that, you know, especially during October, are there campaigns to write your legislator, find out about the laws that are out there, find out about why they haven't been voted in or where are they being stalled? You know, I read a lot of the reason was because a lot of these legislators don't want to sign their name to something that's going to prohibit guns. It has something to do with gun control, which, you know, in my opinion, if you're charged with domestic violence, you better give it up. Give up the gun, and they need to take the gun. I mean, that's realistic.
Part of the law, but basically once we have a piece of legislation that we're supporting at the state level, then part of this organization's role would be to mobilize our volunteers and supporters to write, call, email the legislature, and they do a good job of that. And of course the people on our Survivors Council can also help us work toward that avenue. And I'm very proud of our Survivors Council because they are made up of a combination of people that either stayed in the shelter or received some level of service. They maybe were a volunteer, but they are a survivor of domestic violence. And so they also assist us with just looking at our policies and procedures when it relates to the clients that we serve. And they've given some excellent input about how they feel about some of the policies and procedures that we had in place.
Joanne, can you give us some examples of how you might have had, worked in that realm? Were you've given some personal analysis of policies and procedures and maybe made some suggestions that were overall very positive for the organization and for other survivors?
Yes. One of the things were that we reviewed adhering to the rules of the house and how our opinions were asked on what happens if you break this rule or, you know, what should be done. And, you know, we had to look at it from the safety prospect of all of the victims that were at the home. Another was just taking care of, we have women that have special needs in reference to, what's the one with the, that has to bring her pet in. So we had to make sure that we had rules and regulations set up to accommodate them.
Mm-hmm. So meeting individual accommodations, looking at is it the fairness or updating the rules that people have to abide by or just not maybe accounting for every situation that you come across until they, you know, become a new client? Is that it?
I think it's just an overall review. I mean, it's no different than anything else that we do at my sister's house. We do annual reviews of personal policies and procedures. You know, we want to provide the best service ever. And
sure.
So things change. So what we did 2 years ago, we may not want to do now.
Yeah, because
you know,
it's 2 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Then, but it's not working now.
Right. And how many people, by the way, how many people are on the council?
Seven.
I think it's seven.
Seven, and yeah. So that's a very good representation. And, you know, I always think that, you know, the person who is the survivor or the victim holds the power. As a homicide survivor myself, I know if you go and testify at the legislature or you go and make presentations at law schools and churches and whatnot, we really are the powerful people. And hopefully they listen more than someone who just does it as a profession and gets paid for it. But I don't think that occurs to people until they actually get personal empowerment. Is that your opinion as well? I think it's about being personally empowered once you overcome, you know, what it is that you have overcome.
I think, you know, that a survivor has to get to the point where they feel empowered. And
mm-hmm.
So I feel that most of the people on our Survivors Council, they have really worked to get to that level, and now they feel empowered. You know, many of them had not spoken before, groups before, about their experiences. And so
mm-hmm.
stepped out on faith, and they did, and each time they get better and better.
Yeah.
And they don't just speak, but they help man our tables at events. They help with fundraisers. So they really are important to what we do, and we're really
right.
proud where our Survivors Council have come and the progress they've made.
Mm-hmm.
Well, going back to the Post and Courier article, I've on the last page of that art, or the last section of that article that was written. It's amazing how they have it set up with the problem on one side and the solutions on the other side. Not that these are the solutions that are happening right now, but solutions that we are all looking to achieve. And I think it doesn't speak to just South Carolina. I think there are a lot of course, the whole top 10 and more that can benefit from seeing this and putting some of these things into practice. And I think in what I'm seeing in South Carolina especially is the attitude, the cultural attitude that's been around for a long time and has not changed. And we have to somehow get in the gap there and change this mentality that it's okay, to harm a woman or a child if they're so-called being bad. It's not okay. And I think one of the places that, and you may agree or not with this, Elmir, is the churches. The faith-based community has to stand in that gap somehow. That, I think, is a very important component. And how well are you getting cooperation from the faith-based community as far as helping the victims and becoming a safe haven and a place of resource for victims?
Mm-hmm.
We are very connected and supported by the faith-based community. Actually, our Domestic Violence Coordinating Council, one of our subgroups, is the faith-based committee. And so there is a team of us that actually do the training and the workshops for the faith-based community. As a matter of fact, we will be presenting at the Skavasa State Conference in a couple of weeks on how to engage the first faith-based community in this issue.
Oh, good. Uh-huh. Wow. I think that is a very important component, as Delilah has said. And, you know, we have about 10 minutes remaining to our show, and I wanted to leave some time for some of the activities that are coming up that you are doing, or some other aspects that perhaps we have not touched upon in this hour, Elmire. So you're free to take it away.
Okay, so I want to talk about all of our upcoming activities, which are many. But, of course, our Walk a Mile in Her Shoes is October the 11th. And that's where men wear high heels in support of violence against women. We also have our Charleston Cup Ball and Gala, which is November 7th and 9th. But in between that, we have our golf tournament, which will be at the links at Stono Ferry. We will be doing, for the second time, our Ada's Daughter Society luncheon, which is named after the book Ada's Daughter, and the author, Jacqueline, is a survivor of various levels of abuse. And we're just very fortunate in that she stepped right up to the plate last year when I approached her about us doing this luncheon and naming this society after her book. And so once we will be doing that, as a part of not only education and awareness, but to generate funds to supplement our programs. So when the grant only pays for salary and benefits and it doesn't pay for supplies and transportation and the things that I need for my staff to do their job, then the Ada's Society funds will assist with that.
Oh, that's great.
So we're very pleased with some of the fundraising activities that we have going on.
Is our friend Doug Werner from Liza's Lifeline also involved in your gala ball or whatever? Because I know he's a friend
of the
show.
Absolutely, and he's on our team for training the faith-based community. So
is he? Okay,
yes.
Good.
Well, what other philanthropic organizations do you find in your area, because it may give other organizations ideas as to who they can partner with. I know you're very well thought of by the Zonta International Club. Are there more?
Right.
Well, I think I'm sure there are many. It's just you need to target your community. Like, we have Boeing in our community. We have a number of larger companies, whether that's real estate company, Carolina One, the beach company. And, I mean, we get support from many, many churches of various denominations in our community. And as a matter of fact, we're doing a candlelight visual Monday, the 6th, entitled Sororities Against Domestic Violence. And so my sorority, along with three other sororities, will be doing a candlelight visual, and the Attorney General, Alan Wilson, is our keynote speaker. So I think that organizations have to determine who their allies are.
Mm-hmm.
And work with those allies.
In terms of getting corporate sponsorship or long-term collaborative agreements?
Well, like for both our golf tournament and Walk a Mile, we have title sponsors, but actually both of them are new title sponsors. So I think that you as an organization have to kind of determine, okay, this is what we're doing. Who do we think this will fit into what they want to do?
Their mission or something like
that.
Do you do presentations regarding that, Elmire, for other nonprofits? Because it seems like, you are so skilled with your grant writing and kind of knowing who to approach and what to do and how to do it. And I think, God only knows other areas such as Horry County and all of that really need that infusion of good ideas and doing the same types of things in their area versus yours.
I have done some work with other programs, But, you know, I'm always saying to whether it's my cohorts or other nonprofits, you really have to have a plan. So when I think about the last 2 weeks, you know, we've been very, very blessed. I had, I think, 4 or 5 grant awards that came in.
Wow.
And so I think, you know, it's an ongoing effort. I never turn down the opportunity to write a grant or appear before a group.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mean that I don't get tired or I would like to have a total day off. But I think that it's hard work and you have to make a commitment to do what you're going to do.
Hey, you're preaching to the choir here. I absolutely know what you're talking about. And, you know, we so admire that. Joanne, what is an important message for people out there that, from your perspective, that you think may strike a chord if they haven't gotten to the place that you have?
I think the message would be to not to give up and to seek help. There is help out there. And once you've reached a point wherein you're safe and then you could turn around and give a hand up to another woman.
Right. Now, I'm going to be devil's advocate here. We have 2 minutes. In the outlying areas, because I had this conversation with somebody yesterday, you don't have a job, you don't have much money, you don't own a computer, you don't have a car to drive, you're lacking resources in order to know what the resources are to get help. What does a person like that do? How can they get the help?
Okay. They can, of course, in our area, call our 24-hour hotline, which is 1-800-273-HOPE, and we can connect them to an advocate, because usually there is an advocate no matter how rural a community you live in. Everybody has police or sheriff department. It's just a matter of knowing who to refer that person to.
Okay, so that information. Because most everyone has some type of phone. So very good. Would you like to give any other identifying information or anything about the fundraising activities that you have as we close out our hour here, if people are interested in listening from your area or from South Carolina proper?
No one deserves to be abused, and if anyone is interested in volunteering, donating, participating in our fundraisers, just don't hesitate to call us at 843-747-4069, which is our administrative line, or go to our website, which is www.mysistershouse.org.
Very, very good. Delilah, you have any parting words?
I'm just always so... I love it when Elmer comes on, and I can't wait to get down to meet you, Elmer. I promise you it's coming soon, and I do want to introduce you also to someone in the area that I think could make some very good partnerships with. Anyway,
yes.
I'm just always happy to have you on.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's keep in touch here, and I'm going to be down there in November. I may be a homeowner soon, so we'll have to keep connection. Okay, Elmer?
Hey, thank wonderful.
Great. Thank you, Joanne. We wish you all the success with everything. We're very proud of what you do and always willing to promote. So I'm going to say to everyone, we're going to close out this edition of Shattered Lives, and stay tuned. Until the next show, thank you very much, Delilah. Everyone, be sure to support my sister's house.
Mommy said it's our secret.
Who will believe me? I'm just a kid.
If I'm good and behave myself, everything will be okay.
Daddy works so hard, we have to help him by being good.
If my friends found out, I would die of embarrassment.
A child in an abusive household can feel helpless and without a voice. Learn to notice the signs and speak for them.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.